experiences and reminiscences of Mr. J.C. Hostetler. The interviewer is Betty Trunell, and the narrator is Mr. Hostetler. This recording is being made at the request of the Decatur Public Library in Decatur, Illinois, at the home of Mr. Hostetler at 1552 West Decatur Street in Decatur on February the 20th, 1985. Well, how long have you lived in Decatur, Mr. Hostetler?
I was born and raised in Decatur. I've lived here, I'm 90 years old now.
Well, great. That's a good long life. So you know a lot about our town. How did your family happen to be in Decatur?
My grandfather came from Bedford, Indiana to Decatur sometime before 1858. He was a physician. He was a graduate of the, he went to school in Louisville, Kentucky. He was born in Kentucky. Went to school in Louisville, Kentucky, and he graduated from the Albany Medical College, came to Decatur, and he died in 1958. He had been here about 6 years, and he left his widow, Susan Mary Hostetler, with three sons. My father, William B., was the oldest. Joseph C., from whom I was named, was the middle one, and Robert B. was the youngest. And she took in boarders and roomers, and she put those three men. My father graduated from Albany Medical College. My uncle J.C. graduated from Union College of Schenectady, New York. And my uncle R.B. graduated from Northwestern University in Evanston.
Yeah.
Now.
All right. Your father, of course, married and had a family, and you came along.
Yeah, my father married Minnie Wagoner, who was the daughter of W.H. Wagoner, who was mayor of the city of Decatur and an early businessman here in Decatur. And
he was your grandfather then?
He was my grandfather Wagoner. I never knew my grandfather Hostetler because he was dead.
Yeah.
And my grandmother Hostetler was dead long before I came into the world. And
you remember your grandfather Wagoner, though?
Oh, I remember my grandfather Wagoner, yes. Mm-hmm. Very well.
And he was mayor of Decatur.
He was one of the early mayors of Decatur, yes.
Mm-hmm. Where did you live in your childhood?
We lived in the home that my grandmother Hostetler owned at 250 West Prairie Avenue. And they remodeled it sometime before I was born, and we lived there until my brother and I had the house torn down and made it into a parking lot.
Oh, that must have been rather sad.
That was about 1952.
Uh-huh.
My father was the chief surgeon for this division, the Wabash Railroad, until he became ill in 1907, and he gave that up, but still continued his practice as a general medical doctor until he died in 1913. I was then 18 years old. Oh, I wasn't 18 years old yet. Right at 18. He died in August and I was 18 in September.
Mm-hmm. What about your childhood? How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I had one brother who was 2 years younger than I am, and one sister who was 5 years older. And we have been very close all through life. We never divided our inheritance, and our brother Bill was a successful insurance partner in the firm of Bennett and Shade here. And my sister married a doctor, and a Dr. Ralph Wiley, and she later left Decatur and went to Fontenelle, Iowa, where she lived and where she died.
Mm-hmm. And that's her picture over
and
there.
And that's her picture right over
beautiful
there.
Beautiful girl.
A very pretty girl. She went to Millikan University for 3 or 4 years, and then went to the University of Minnesota at Minneapolis and graduated there. And she was a popular girl, and many of my acquaintances I made because they were friends of my sister.
They wanted to meet your sister, really.
Yeah. So, you know, whether you're successful in life or not, about 40% of it depends upon who you know, and 60% of what you know after you get a chance to prove it.
Looking back on your childhood, what are your impressions?
Well, my uncle, J.C., was a bachelor, and my father was much older, you see. He wasn't married until he was in his 40s, so he was much older, and Uncle J.C. was a man who had a lot of fun in life, and he saw to it that, he took my brother Bill and me over, for example, to Indiana, and we met all the Hostetler tribe and the Newland tribe that lived there in Bedford. We visited with those neighbors. He took us both to French Lick Springs, and he put me through school. He furnished the money for me to go to school at the University of Illinois, because my father was dead and gone. We were about the only young kids in that double block there, and two in the 300 block on West Prairie Avenue, and we had neighbors, Uncle Frank and Aunt Alice Caldwell, and Uncle Montgomery and Mrs. Montgomery, and the Scruggs, W.R. Scruggs and his wife, and Lily Chadsey, and Uncle Loeb and Annie Loeb, Peter Loeb and his wife, and B. O. McReynolds and his wife, and O.B. Gorin and his wife. They were all old residents there, and we were the only kids in the neighborhood in 04 until we got to be 7 or 8 years old. Then the the widow Mrs. A.T. Hill, she lived on the corner of Prairie and Church in the big house there, and her only son, Ed, came to live with her and with his wife and the three Hill kids. And we played all around the block. I had an Aunt Carrie Hostetler who lived right back across the alley from our home. She was on William Street, and she had two daughters and two granddaughters, and I had a lot of fun with those two girls too. But mainly it was Uncle J.C. who saw to it that we got to the picnic, to the carnivals, to the racetrack, and to the ball game, and things of that kind, you see. Things that bachelor men do rather than what married men do.
That you loved it as
well. And we had a, later on in my life, I was very well acquainted with S.C. Kenny, the local abstractor here, in the business way, and she said she knew my uncles A.C. and she knew my father. She used to tell me, she said, "Well, you and your brother certainly had one of the happiest childhoods I ever knew." Well, and that's true.
That's
we did have.
Uh-huh. Then you went to the University of Illinois.
Then I went to the University of Illinois in 1911, and I had planned on studying law, and at that time you had to have 3 years of liberal arts, and then you went to the law school for 3 years. And I completed only 2 years of the law school, and I flunked in evidence, and they put me on probation, and that was in the June of 1915, and my uncle J.C. died in September. And I had to stay here and look after his estate, and it took a year and a half for me to, I cleaned up my father's estate and my uncle's estate. And then, by that time, we got into the war in 1917, World War I, and I was drafted among the first group to appear before the draft board in the summer of 1917, and I'd had a super rating year since I was 6 years old, and they classified me 4F, and I stayed in on, and I completed the estate work, and through a cousin of mine, Dr. Herschel Knapp of Chicago, who was a very good friend of Brigadier General Niskins, who was head of the Zone 7 Supply Depot Quartermaster Corps in Chicago. And in the fall of 1917, they were opening up a Quartermaster General's Packing House Division in that big depot in Chicago. And they were looking for clerks and people like that. And through General Niskin, being a 4F, I got in there, and they assigned me to buying packing house products for the camps and posts in the United States. It was purely a case of sending out to the camps for material as to what their estimates were of how many men they had to feed for the next month.
When you say packing house, you mean meat packing?
I mean meat packing, that's right. Mm-hmm. Packing house, well, all packing house products. Cereal, bacon, cooking oil, beef, turkeys, anything in connected with mm-hmm. the packing house division. And we assembled all that information of what their demands were, and then those figures were submitted to Congress and appropriations were made. Then we had to put out for bids, and when we received the bids, then we tabulated those, and Major Skiles, who was the head of that end of the whole business, he'd been a sergeant in the regular army up in New York, he put his initials on it, and that went in then, and the contracts were let, and I gained a major appreciation of the ability of the big packers to meet such tremendous demands that we placed on them. For example, you see, the armistice was declared, I believe it was on the 12th of November, and a group of personnel in the Quartermaster Corps there in the hardware department took the tops of the GI cans and came marching up through our section, you know, having a big parade, and they called the whole thing off. The whole Quartermaster Corps was discharged for that day. We went down to Chicago and yelled and screamed and joined the crowds down there. We came back the next day and we were requested to procure Christmas dinners, no, Thanksgiving dinners for all the army and posts in the country. And those packing houses, the big packers, Swift and Armour and Cuddy and Morris, they were able to commandeer the turkey market and ship turkeys, dressed turkeys, to every camp and post in the United States for the Thanksgiving meal. How they did it, they got turkeys all over the country.
Amazing.
How they did it, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So that was Armistice Day.
That was Armistice Day, 1918.
A great day.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And you see, unlike World War II, immediately after the armistice was signed, many contracts to supply war materials to the army were canceled, and they started dismissing from the service any of these men, like me, for example, who either had a job to return to or had something that they wanted to do. I got out of the army on the 19th day of January in 1919 and went down in my...
Do you mean 1919?
1919.
The war ended in 1918.
In 1918.
Right. You're right.
In November 1918. Right. In January 19th, 1919, and I got into my issued uniform and winter coat and hat and went down to Champaign and was able to enter the University of Illinois for the second quarter. And I spent the second and third quarters of 1919 and all four quarters of 1920 there and got my AB degree from the university in 1920.
So, but you hadn't switched courses.
I gave up the law.
And went into?
And went, when I returned to the university in 1919, I specialized in the business part of the liberal arts college, economics, mm-hmm. marketing, foreign trade, corporate finance.
You had quite a bit of good experience in your work in the army.
I had some good experience there. I had a lot of, in the law school, I liked the law that I liked, I got along very well with, in the real estate and torts and the criminal law. But when they got to equity pleading and evidence, which was the difficult part of it, I was way over my head. I was too young.
Yes.
But I graduated in that period when all the boys from the liberal arts business angel of the college. They went in either into the bond business or the insurance business. And my brother Bill, he had gone 19, he got out of the Army late 1919, and he entered Wharton School of Commerce in Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania, and he specialized in insurance. So I chose the bond business, and I was chosen from the university graduates that year to go with Halsey Stewart and Company. And it was through Halsey Stewart and Company that I met my wife. During the war, she had gone to work for a good friend of their families, Mr. Clarence McNeil, who was the treasurer of Halsey Stewart and Company, and she was his assistant, did the buying and so forth. So when I showed up to Halsey Stewart as a bond salesman, I knew Beatrice's brother Phil at the University of Illinois. I met her right away, and we had a glorious courtship. And 2 years later, we were married.
May I interrupt you? You
yes.
said she was English.
Oh, yes.
How did she, what was she doing in this country?
Well, when I said she was English, I meant to tell you that, well, her father and her mother both were Canadians. They came over, their family had come over from England to Canada, and then from Canada they came to Illinois, and Beatrice's father was with Solomon Smith when he founded the Northern Trust Company, and he was a banker there. He wound up as the vice president of the Northern Trust Company and retired a couple of years after we were married. But it was through Dad King that I learned of A.D. Langworthy, who was the loan agent of the John Hancock Mutual Life Insurance Company. And he wanted to get a loan representative down here in this area. So when I left Halsey Stewart, I came back to Decatur and went in the mortgage loan business, making farm loans for insurance companies. Well, that's sort of a long story. But anyway.
We have plenty of time.
Horace McDavid, who was one of my sister's old beaus, he was, and W.R. McGoy were both friends to me, and made it possible for me to get that business established. And I operated it in the Orlando Hotel building very successfully until 1929. And in 1929, Matheny Dixon and Company, or in Springfield, who had been the Prudential agents, loan agents over there, went busted, and they were looking for somebody to take over that business. And I was able to get Springfield and Peoria and Jacksonville. So we had three offices there, all of them making residential loans, and we were doing very well, had a good record. And then the stock market debacle came in 29, and that was followed by the depression years in the 30s. And in 1933, when the bank moratorium was declared, the Prudential canceled all of their loan contracts, and we were put out of business. The man who was managing the Springfield office and the man at the Peoria office both went to Chicago and went to work with the Prudential. And I had to stay and clean up the business the following year. And in 1934, the Prudential offered me a job as assistant manager in charge of loans in a new office to be opened, branch office to be opened in Cincinnati. So we left our home here, put everything in storage, and moved to Cincinnati. And there I had a very wonderful experience. We had loans in West Virginia, in Ohio, in Indiana, in Kentucky, and that was all my territory to clean up that mess. We had a lot of difficulties. For example, when General Motors closed up the Frigidaire plant in Dayton, Ohio, we had all the big residential loans in the city because we were the only people that Prudential was the only one who would lend more than $25,000 on a home. And those Frigidaire men lost their jobs just like that, and they left, scattered all over the country. And we had those loans, which were turned over to the property department, and all the good ones were kept immediately, laid aside, and a few years later they were sold out, and the Prudential recaptured all of their investments. We had a tremendous investment in Indianapolis, and before I left the Prudential in 36, we got a telegram one day from the home office to go to Indianapolis and settle the Monahan foreclosures. The Monahans had number of big apartment buildings over there, and they got into difficulties, financial difficulties, and they owed the General Electric Company for appliances, and they owed back taxes, and the Prudential had started foreclosure and had gotten to the point where they were to take over the property, and the home office said, we're not going to acquire another $5 million worth of real estate in Indianapolis. So we went to Indianapolis, canceled the foreclosure proceedings, gave the property back to the Monahans, paid off the General Electric Corporation for all the refrigerators, gave them $50,000 worth of working capital, and in the next 5 years, the Monahans came out smelling like a rose too. Well, anyway, it was a great experience. But I realized after being there for 3 years that I had no home office connections with the Prudential. And the men who were getting ahead were the men who knew people back east in the Newark office. And so I made up my mind I was going to get out. And I learned of the National Life of Vermont, and I went up to Montpelier and interviewed them, and they agreed that I could go as a loan agent for them in this territory or in Decatur. I came back here happy to come back home, and lo and behold, the Northwestern Life Insurance Company was making farm loans at 4.5% interest. And the cheapest money I could get from the John Hancock was 5%, and it was 5% from the National Life of Vermont. So it was impossible to even get started. I didn't even have open an office. And McGoy, who was a friend of my sister's and a friend of McDavid's, he said that there was an opening in the Millikan Bank. They had a...
Mr. Hostetler, you talk about giving all these loans. Did you have problems with meeting people who had lost their homes or their businesses and were in dire straits?
No, that part of the business was handled through the legal department. And when I went to the Prudential, practically all of the properties that we had acquired had gone through foreclosure, and the people were out and away. I had one experience. I had to go to Dayton, Ohio, to see a man who was high up in the Eastern Gas Company. And we had a loan on his home there in Dayton, in a good section of Dayton. And he was ill. His wife was in Europe on a trip. They were high livers. And I talked to him, and he agreed to give us a deed to his property in lieu of foreclosing on it. And after his wife came back from Europe, they moved out and we acquired the property. That's the only case that I recall of that I had anything to do with the actually taking the property away from the borrower. And that wasn't a very unpleasant place. I didn't have any trouble there at all. That didn't bother me. There were, of course, in any business, I don't care what it is, you have some disadvantages. Usually it's the irritations are among either the people that you have to work under or people that you have to work with. Occasionally you'll get cross personalities, and it's rather trying. But I came back to Decatur. You, and one of the questions you asked me was if I had any recollection of teachers who had a great deal of influence in my life. And I tell you, I did have. When I went back to the university after my first 4 years, I took all the courses in philosophy that the university at that time taught. And I learned from Professor Bodie, we used to call him Ping Bodie, P-I-N-G, Bodie. He went from the university. And I remember what Bodie said one time. He said, young graduates, he said, make up your mind where you want to live. Then go there and find something to do. So I came back to Decatur. My family was here. They'd been here for personally, well, they've been here over 100 years now. And our interests were here, so I came back to Decatur. And I went in the Millikan Bank. There were some very irritating situations in there, and I developed an ulcer, sure, along with all the rest of them. But it was work I liked, and we got the real estate mortgage loan situation pretty well cleaned up. Sometimes it was trying. I had a lot of real estate to dispose of for the bank, but in 1941, my good school friend Everett Mueller came to me. I had been doing a lot of work on the City Planning Commission, and he came to me and wanted me to do some work for the Mueller Company, purely outside of the bank, and I did. And the result of that was that Everett offered me a job in the Mueller Company. And in 1941, I told the officers of the Millikan Bank that I was either going to be made an officer and a loan officer of the Millikan Bank, or I was going to go to the Mueller Company. So that resulted in by being named a vice president, and they turned over the municipal bond business to me, and I became a director of the Millikan Bank. Well, that was pretty satisfying in many ways, but it was also pretty irritating because we had We had a change in the leadership of the Millikan, the James Millikan Trust, and Dr. Silas McClellan assumed the place that had been vacated by Mr. O.B. Gorin's demise, and he was a hard taskmaster, and he established, he insisted upon having a legal department, so he named his nephew, Lee Boylan, the legal department of the Millikan National Bank, and of course I had a lot to do with in that department, and although I had never had any hard words with Lee, but he was a man who was a perfectionist, and the detail he made me go through sometimes was very, very tiresome. But anyway, well, things went along all right, and I was very happy in the financial end of it. Came out with some, I stayed in the bank until I was 69. Mm-hmm. I retired. I've been out of the bank 21 years. Mm-hmm. I found out that the average man had a fluctuating value of honesty. He was honest when he thought somebody might see him. But he was only too prone to take advantage if he could do so. We had numerous cases of men making purchases and then issuing a check for them and coming back thinking they'd made a bad buy on that secondhand automobile. I remember one man who bought a lot of secondhand gas cylinders. He was in the gas, compressed gas business, and he thought the cylinders weren't as good as he thought they were. Stop payment on their checks, you know, and there we had a disgruntled seller and a disgruntled purchaser. Cases like that showed up. I remember one time, one of the tellers, Naomi, what was Naomi's name? It doesn't make any difference. Naomi settled up that day and she was $100 short. Mm-hmm. And she asked me, she said, will you take me out to see Mrs. So-and-so? And I said, I sure will. She had thought back and she remembered one transaction in which $100 was involved. And we went out and we called on the woman. Very pleasant and all. She wasn't about to come into the bank and give us the money, but she didn't make any defense at all. She said, yes, I've got the money, and she turned it back to him. Things like that. The bank gives away matches, you know. Mm-hmm. The other day I stood there at the counter writing a counter check, and two men were on the other side. They were black men, but I knew that they couldn't reach over and punch me in the face. And this one of them had grabbed a whole handful of matches, and I looked him straight in the eye and I said, you know, you're only supposed to take one. He said, well, I smoked two packs of cigarettes today, and he said, these will only last me a couple of days. Things like that happen in the bank. You'd be surprised how many people take advantage of the bank if they get the opportunity to do so.
Has this always been true?
I think it's pretty generally true of the American people.
During your whole experience.
In my experience, it's been true. Mm-hmm. It certainly has. I think that, well, I'm not going to tell you what I think about that. I have been a firm believer in the statement that I am the captain of my fate and I am the master of my soul. I think that all of us are what we are by the decisions we make all the way through our life. I just don't know. You won't run across another man in this town who is any more lucky than I am.
Mm-hmm.
I had a marvelous father and mother. I had generations of Mennonite blood from my ancestor who came from Switzerland and settled in western Pennsylvania. The Indians massacred his wife and his daughter in 1758. They took my ancestor, Christian Hostetler, back into the Ohio Valley. He was a,
the Indians did?
The Indians. He lived, he was adopted by an Indian family. He lived with the Indians until he was 18 years old, and he came back then into Pennsylvania, ran away, and I am in the seventh generation of Christian Hostetler. Mennonite blood all the way through the line, you see. On the Wagner side, they were Dutch, Holland Dutch. So I was just lucky. You know, we don't get to choose our parents at all. But I had marvelous parents. I had a marvelous girl to marry. I married her because I loved her, and her father and mother were like my father and mother. I liked her brothers. We got along perfectly. So we had 62 years of happy married life. And, well, that's longer than lots of people live. Beatrice had her 90th birthday on September the 10th, and I had mine on the 90th on September 23rd. She had been sick since 1975 with heart trouble. She lived till the 14th day of October afterwards, and then she died.
Uh-huh.
Died peacefully, without pain, and
you had a good life together.
I've had a good life, and I've worked hard. As I told you, my relationship with my sister and my brother, just absolutely perfect. Okay. Bill and I have been together in business all the way through the things. We've never had an angry word about anything, and we've worked hard, and we've prospered.
Very good.
When I left the bank, I had enough money, income, to live comfortably as long as I lived.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
We've been ahead of inflation, and that's been a horrible thing for the average American who wasn't a wage earner and in a position where his income or his salary was raised as inflation increased.
Mm-hmm.
So that I'm honest, I'm thankful for it, and I appreciate it. I've been extraordinarily lucky.
Very good. Well, let's talk for a minute about banking.
Yes.
It's changed a great deal while you were in the business.
Well, banking is a fascinating business in this respect, that it involves all kinds of people, all kinds of manufacturing, all kinds of industry. You never know what propositions are going to be submitted to you in the day's work when you open up the door and come in the bank at 8 o'clock in the morning. I not only had the advantage of schooling at the University of Illinois, but in 1947, they opened up in the University of Wisconsin the Middle States School of Banking. Only officers of banks and college graduates were permitted to register. And I went to McGoy and told him that I was interested in that and I wanted to go. We had sent men out to the Rutgers School of Banking, but they never had completed the work. And McGoy, a good friend of mine, he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do." He said, "You go up, you pay your own expenses, and when you've completed," he said, "if you've completed satisfactorily," he said, "the bank will reimburse you." Well, the three sessions, 2 week sessions each year up there at the University of Wisconsin was an education in itself. We were exposed to men like Mr. Shimczak, who was head of the Federal Reserve Bank, the head of the American Farm Bureau Association. We had bankers, we had men, all kinds of men, way up on all kinds of ability. Our professors, nearly all of them, were Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan teachers. And when we completed those courses, if we did our work, we were exposed to information that that we could handle no matter what office we went into in the bank. And banking was interesting because of that. It's a profession like the medical profession and like the legal profession. They call us, we claim that we're professional men, but we're professional men mainly in the fact that you have to be a student all the way through or else you get lost. Too many bankers come into a bank as right out of business college and they learn the banking business from how it's being done by the officers ahead of them. They don't have the history of finance, they don't have the history of banking, they don't have anything, any knowledge of business cycles. Things of that kind, that the bankers that they have to have. And things have changed more since I left the bank because of the greater intrusion of government forms, government rules, and requirements. For example, now, today, if the Millikan Bank turns me down for a request for a loan, they have to keep a record of it and they have to report to some government agency why they didn't give me the loan.
Well, why is that? I mean, why did they do that? Well,
that was a it's just an outgrowth of a number of things, but I think mainly it's the outgrowth of minority groups in the United States clamoring that they don't get a fair deal. Not only in the banking business, but everywhere else, in the wages and in the factories and everything else. We we're in an age where everybody who is disappointed by a decision claims that he has been unfairly dealt with, and he goes to a lawyer and sues, claiming that somebody has stepped on his freedom and his social status. And it's terrible.
The physical setup of banks have changed.
The whole thing has changed. Modern banking came in after 1933 with the establishment of the Federal Reserve System and the seven Federal Reserve banks. Before that, all the country banks used what we call the Central Reserve Cities, the big banks in New York and Chicago and San Francisco. They were the depositories of the bank's monies. And the difficulty with that situation was that when the Millikan Bank had difficulties here, the bank down in New York where their money was, they were having just the same difficulties, only they were having big ones when we were having little ones. The Federal Reserve completely revolutionized that part of it, but there has been, that has opened up another whole field of regulation, and the bank regulations are very strict. I don't know them like I should by any manner of means, but I was instrumental in bringing a man in the bank who had been a bank examiner, a national bank examiner, and Manly Peterson was the best informed man on the National Banking Act that I had anything to do with. He worked his way through the University of Illinois. He was a very well-posted man. But that government interference, well, it came in under the Federal Housing Administration, making of loans, real estate loans. We used to, when we started in, if we loaned more than 60% of the fair valuation of a residence, we just turned the loan down. FHA came in and started making loans at 80%, and then they raised it, politicians, they raised it to 90%, and finally, after we got into the GI loans to the veterans after World War II, all the veterans had to put in was the expense of the attorneys and the surveyor and the recorder. $300 or $400 was all they put up to buy a $30,000 house.
Do you think most of those were honored? Did they come through all right? We
got into it. We got into that lending. We tried to be very conservative with it, and up to the time when I left the bank in 1963, we had had a very satisfactory experience. But a lot of that was due to inflation. The fellow didn't have any equity when he started in, but the increase in the value of his house, his mortgage remained the same or a little bit less, so his equity was gradually going up. Now it's just the reverse of that, which the farmer has experienced today. Again, the federal land banks, the insurance companies, even the banks themselves, they made a lot of loans to these farmers to permit them to buy high-priced land. The farmer should have known that if he borrowed, if he had to borrow $1,000 an acre, and many of them borrowed as much as $1,800 to $2,000 an acre, they were having to pay 9% to 10% interest for that money. And they should have known from their own experience as farmers, they just could not farm that land and make that kind of money over and above the cost of raising the stuff. But the bad crop years, the embargo, the grain embargo to Russia was a terrible mistake. Had a horrible effect on the farmer. That coupled with a couple of bad years over here in Iowa on their farms, their income because of weather conditions. Same was true in Kansas. These men who thought they could pay for this land just got into a position where they couldn't do it. And now with the, where they no longer have any equity, no, the land isn't worth anything in excess of the mortgage debt that there is on it. They're in difficulty. And you don't read much about it in the papers, but some of the big corporate finance, big operators are in the same boat that the little farmers in. But there are about 50% of the farmers in this beautiful land area from, there's a belt from Iowa, southern Iowa, northern Missouri, central Illinois, central Indiana, and Ohio. It's a black belt. A very rich soil, very productive soil, and in those areas, over 50% of the farmers either own their land outright or owe such a small sum of money that even though there's been a big decline in the value, they're still self-sufficient and they're going to come out all right. But the farmer, you'll see, when I was in the bank, we used to loan the maximum amount of money to Siebes Hatchery up at Lincoln, Illinois. And they shipped eggs, they shipped incubator chickens any place in the United States that, where the chicks could be delivered in 48 hours. Siebes Hatchery's out of business now. There aren't any chickens on any of these farms. The hatcheries only are furnishing chicks to the breeders of chicks and to the so-called batteries, where they have 5 feeding arms.
Like factories.
With chickens, this one they've taken the chickens out this week and they're cleaning it up. The other 4, there'll be one out the next week. And by the end of this week, this outfit will have another 5,000 chickens in it. Chicken business has gone completely. No, you don't see a chicken on the farm. You don't see a milk cow on the farm anymore. Agriculture is, my father used to say, oh, they're the most independent people. They're self-sufficient. Well, they aren't anymore. They get their ice cream the same place you get yours. They get their milk the same place you buy your milk. And except that most of those things are delivered there. At the gasoline and all those things are delivered there by somebody whose business it is to just circle around. They're totally dependent upon gasoline, diesel fuel, rubber tires, tractors. We used to go through the fields in the fall and we'd pick out the exceptionally good ears of corn. Jerk them off, put them on a rack in the barn and dry them, and that was our seed corn for next year. Today we pay as high as $42 for a 50-pound bag of that kind of stuff. They're all hybrid seeds, you see. The same thing is true with, we pay $10 a bushel for bean seed regularly. I don't think anything about it.
Do you think it's better this way?
The corn is better. We produce where we used, when my father died, if we got 60 bushels of corn to the acre and got 50 cents a bushel for it, we were pretty well satisfied. Today, if we don't raise 150 bushels to the acre, we want to know why. We pay $42 for a bag of seed corn that will plant 3 acres, and we spend, the landlord spends about $50 an acre before anything comes up out of the ground that looks like corn or wheat or beans. And if he doesn't get reasonably favorable weather, he doesn't recoup that loss. And you use the best information you can get. The biggest the biggest advantage the farmer has is the land grant colleges, agricultural colleges like the University of Illinois, Indiana, and all these other state universities. The findings, the education that they give these people, and the information that they make available to the farmer who never saw the inside of a college. They have the advantage of the very best technical knowledge that is known to the country. And most of the farmers do a pretty good job of it. But just like everybody else, every once in a while there's a crooked banker, and every once in a while there's a crooked lawyer, and every once in a while there's a doctor who, even the minister once in a while goes wrong, you know.
Well, on the whole, would you say we're better off than we were? Or what is your feeling?
Well,
about life today, is it better than it was or not?
I sometimes question it. Now, you asked me a question about what we did for our recreation. Well, there were always 7 of us there at home, and we didn't have TV or we didn't have a radio, but we did have a phonograph, and my mother could play the piano, and we played cards occasionally, and we read. My brother and I couldn't wait to get the motor age every Saturday that came, and the Scientific American, and we had the YMCA to go to. That was the only gymnasium in town for kids, the YMCA. None of the schools had gymnasiums in those days. My father had always had 2 horses in the barn. We had a pony, and we had 2 cows, and he always had a stableman who take care of the horses and milk the cows. And Bill and I used to ride out with John Haley and with Charlie Long and a little pony cart out to the end of Cantrell Street in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And we'd wait till they'd milk the cow, and they'd put the cans of milk back in the little wagon, and we'd come back home. Mm-hmm. We had barns, we had chickens, we had a lot of duties, yes. There were things we did, although mother always had help, my father always had this stableman, you see. But
did they help live in the home? Did your mothers help live at home in your house? Or did they come by the day?
They, well, we had, I'll have to go back. My grandfather Hostetler, someplace, met up with a little girl who